head coach of the Western Kentucky Hilltoppers, Jeff Ross. Today I'm with Matt Jones, Kevin Harnett, Pat Forty. I'm with the new Chariot, Kristen Wall, United States Congressman John Yarman, Sarah Bohanser, and
welcome to the Rusty Satellite Show with your host, Rick Redding. The show airs every week exclusively here on the Louisville.am Podcast Network. Rick's ready to start ranting and raving about his hometown right now. So, here's Rick.
And thank you once again for downloading the Rusty Satellite Show here on the Louisville.am Network. This is Rick Redding, your host. I strive each and every week to bring you two of the most interesting people in the Ville. And this week's guests are certainly quite interesting. I'm going to tell you about them in just a second. First, I want to thank my sponsor, Passport Health Plan. Passport is planning to move their headquarters to the West End at 18th and Broadway in the very near future, and they're just a great company. I'm really proud to be associated with Passport, and you'll hear more about them later in the show. But first of all, let's tell you about my guest. Now, this week in Louisville, my good friend Chris Thieneman went out and met, you'll love this story. He met a guy named Norm Stamper because he read a book about policing, and Chris's big issue now has to do with the police. And Stamper wrote a book called "To Protect and Serve: How to Fix America's Police." And Chris brought him in here from Seattle to talk to some people. They went around town, did some great things. So that's coming up in the second part of the show. My first guest is also the author of a new book. It is Mike Rutherford, and his book is 100 Things Louisville Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. It's a very interesting book. The timing of it is interesting. The foreword in the book is Rick Pitino writing about how great it is here at Louisville and all the things that are going on. So you might know Mike from his Ramsey and Rutherford radio show that has just come back to town. He was on a hiatus. He was on a rare non-compete blackout, I guess you would call it. He's been off the air for 6 months, but just came back on in the last week or so. His book has just come out, and you'll hear in the interview some opportunities you can go out and meet Mike and get a signed copy of his book. But I really like Mike. He's a very humble guy, but he's doing a lot of really cool, important stuff. And I was really happy that we got to reminisce a little bit about the what we were both doing. We'd never met, but we were both doing sort of the same thing. We're both among the first bloggers in this city. Mike started his Card Chronicle blog way back, I think he said 2006. That was the year I started the Ville Voice, and Mike was a big follower of that back in the day. So anyway, there's a lot going on there. But I was really interested in having him on talk about this book and some of the things that are going on with the athletics department over at the University of Louisville. And, of course, if you want to hear him ramble about that topic every day, he's on 790 WKRD on a daily basis in the afternoon with John Ramsey. And that's always interesting if you're into sports talk radio. There's a lot going on there. It's a fascinating thing. So anyway, I'm going to get out of the way here and let you hear my interview with Mike Rutherford, and then I'll be back to talk about some other stuff.
I admit, I used to think people addicted to painkillers just needed to toughen up, until it happened to my daughter. She really needed help. Thanks to Passport, we got it for her. Our doctor and her Passport case manager made sure she got the services and treatment she needed. Together, we got through it.
Find out how you can get Passport at passporthealthplan.com/together. Passport Health Plan. We're in this together.
And we're back in the Louisville.am studios, and I'm with Mike Rutherford, who's really in the news, or at least talking about things in the news a lot lately. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rick. I've been a big fan for a long time. I told you off air I used to read the Ville Voice. Boy, pretty consistently.
Those were the days, weren't they?
And I said I read it during law school, and I got caught, and I wasn't paying any attention. And that's not just some like anecdote. That legitimately happened just about on a daily basis.
Well, those were fun times, but you know, media and journalism changed dramatically. Mm-hmm. And you were smart enough in the very beginning to start a website devoted to U of L sports, Card Chronicle. What year was that?
I believe I started the first one in 06, and I made the move to Card Chronicle in 07, so I was still in college.
Okay. Well, cool. Well, the Ville Voice actually was birthed in 06, and we really got going in 07. So
we're both like 450 years old in internet years.
I keep telling people, I was the first blogger, and, you know, Here you are. You're right there. You probably we have to check the dates to see who was first. But anyway, I wanted to have you on. I heard about this great book that you've written and actually got published, and you brought me one. Thank you very much. 100 Things Louisville Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. So, what was that like? How do you write a book?
Well, first of all, timing being my thing, Rick Pitino writes the foreword, so yeah. That's beautiful. Choose to view it as a reflection on better times if you want to read it that way. The foreword's also him basically saying how great things are going to be going forward, so it's just perfect. But
that's worth the cost of the book right there, and just sales, to see what's changed.
Ironically enough, sales went way up the past week when all this stuff was going down, so I think people love Macabre, I guess. But Triumph Publishing reached out to me last fall and said, we've got this idea. It's a series. Other programs have done it. Other franchises have done it. Would you be interested? And me, being an idiot, said, yeah, it's the busiest time of the year. Why not? Let's
go ahead.
Easy. We got college basketball starting up. We've got radio going on. We got all these things happening.
There's only 100 of them.
Right? Yeah, I can write a book. That's you think that way, though. You're like, I know all about Louisville sports. 100 things, like games, all this stuff, it's no problem. You get to like 68 and you're like, oh my God.
What else?
I drastically underestimated this project. But it was a lot of work, but a lot of fun. A lot of people were willing to talk to me, and I think I got a lot of stories that people know about, maybe elements within those stories that they didn't know about, and then I think there are a few anecdotes in there that are probably being told for the first time.
Okay, well, cool. Well, it's thick, and it's got a lot of words in it. I'm very impressed. And it's not all pictures. But anyway, I've lived here a long time. I thought it would be fun to see if you can stump me. Tell me some of the things that a Louisville fan should know, and I'll tell you whether I know it or not.
Okay, the thing that I really did not know, so John Wooden announced his retirement after the famous 1975 game, whether they beat Louisville, the missed free throw.
Terry Howard.
Exactly. So he's on the court. He's celebrating with the players. It's this dramatic overtime victory. And some booster comes up to him, and they're like, you know what? I bet you feel like you owed us that after last year. They lost in the Final Four the year before, the only time in, I think, like 11 years. And so he, right at that moment, said, if this is what this program's become, where this is the expectation every year and nobody's having fun if you lose, I want out. And so he went to the media right afterward and was like, I'm done, and beats Kentucky two nights later for the national title. I did not know that until I looked into it and talked to some people. But there's some other stuff like that. Louisville being the only program to win all sets of national titles, all big sorts of college basketball national titles, the NAIB, now NAIA national title, the NIT when it was a big deal, and then obviously the NCAA now three times. So stuff like that, I think, is, maybe you've heard a little bit about it, but you don't know the background. You don't know why the NAIB was such a big deal in the 40s. You don't know why the NIT was seen by some to be more prestigious than the NCAA for a long period of time. And I think the book, hopefully, does a good job of explaining that.
Well, good. I like some of the chapters already. The top 10 T-Will-isms.
T-Will-isms are good. Yeah.
Those are good. Louisville Marquette. All right. That's all good stuff. So you had to find all this stuff, I guess, just do research, right? You just looked it up?
Yeah, some of it was, things that I'd written in the past that could be reworked a little bit. The T-Willisms was a post that I did on his senior day, and I found some. There's a good one about David Padgett there, too, about how he's like the cow that leads them to water and all this stuff. But, stuff like that you could kind of reinvent a little bit. But then there were other things. Like, I had never written extensively about Charlie Tyree, who's now in the news a little bit more, or Johnny Unitas. And you've got to kind of go out and find books about those people, because there aren't just articles floating around the internet. Yeah. As famous as they were, it's been so long that you can't find really good factual information about those people. So those were more work than I was expecting going in, but you got to cover them because they are a huge part of U of L's history.
There you go. All right, well, before we get off the book, let me give you an opportunity to tell people how to get it.
Right now, they say October 15th is the release date. They really kind of let it out about a week ago. So anywhere you can buy books, it's available now. I know it's at Carmichael's here locally. I know it's at Barnes & Noble. It's obviously on Amazon. Peaked in the top 500 of Amazon, which was very cool, the first day of pre-sales. And I was glad that I pushed the pre-sales given everything that happened in the weeks afterward. But I'll be signing books on the first Sunday of November at the Barnes & Noble on South Hurstburn, and then I'll be at the one in the Summit, I guess Paddock Shops now, on December 10th. So I'll publish those dates more on my site, but tentative. If anybody out there, for whatever reason, wants me to sign something, you can stop by there and talk to my mom.
Gee, I don't see your signature on my copy.
I can do that. Yeah, you and my mom will be the first signings.
All right, well, Let's move on to talk about it. Certainly, you've had success with this website, and you have this radio show. And there was a little controversy, and I tried to have you on a couple months ago to talk about the book, and we couldn't because you were in a non-compete, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
I don't know how much of that story you want to tell, but you basically had to sit out a non-compete, which is rare in media these days.
And it's frustrating because, you know, I was trying to do book stuff on podcasts like these and, you know, try to do radio spots, and I was given very strict instructions that you can't do those types of things, and that's frustrating for somebody like me. But it's the way the business works, I guess. It's my first time moving from one job to another within the same industry. But, yeah, I mean, I've said this now on my new show. I said it on the website when I announced that we were leaving. I've got zero bad blood with anybody at ESPN Louisville. I still talk to a lot of those guys, still like a lot of those guys. John really fought tooth and nail for me to get that job. I know you've had John on the show before, too. He's a really good guy, and I really needed that job at the time. I think it was 3 years ago when he called me up, and there were people over there who didn't want me to have that job, yeah. And John really went to bat for me. And so when he was unhappy with some things that were going on and had the opportunity to make this move and came to me and said, I really, you know, would like you to come with me. It was a tough decision for me. I knew it was going to be awkward. I knew it was going to be weird, and I don't like awkward or weird. But I felt like I really owed him one, and that's that. For me, it's sort of a simple story.
Yeah, well, John's a great guy, of course, a big booster, and he's very positive, I guess I would say. I've been listening to some of your shows the last few days.
He is that.
He's really on the side of, like, Jurich.
He's got a lot of energy.
And Patino and all those guys. So I want to ask you, not necessarily your opinion on the stuff going on in U of L, but as a media guy, and somebody who's on the radio all the time, I mean, all this controversy at U of L, it's got to be good for business. I mean, the interest in the sports, in basketball and football, and what's going on with Tom Jurich, that's got to help your listenership, right?
It does, but I feel like I'm sort of alone in that I still don't view things that way. I still view myself as more of a fan first, and all this other stuff has just sort of come about because of that. And so when bad things happen, when, you know, Louisville's in the news for the wrong reasons, I don't think, yay, like radio listeners, yay, traffic. And we did have our, I think, our second biggest traffic day ever was the day that they announced that Tom was being fired. But I still think, you know, first, woe is me as a fan. And then I go on the air and try to cope with that. I think there are people who don't do that, and I understand that. It does become, you know, when you're getting paid to do something, it does take up more of a chunk of your life, and it does change the way you view things to a certain extent. But I've tried to keep my distance as much as I can, even now, because I love being a fan. It's one of my favorite things about my life. I love going to games and tailgating and talking with my friends like we all have for the past 30 years. And having said that, without question, it's good for our radio show to have controversy. It's good when things are really bad or when they're really good. People want to talk about that. And so to come back when we did, would we have liked it to have been under sunnier circumstances? Absolutely. But we have had no shortage of phone calls here in the first 2 weeks of the show.
Golly, I was thinking yesterday when I was thinking about having you on that I certainly remember in sports that you know, basketball season would sort of sneak up on you because you were talking about football, and you're actually talking about things going on the field all the time. And now, of course, that's not – it must help to be a fan rather than being somebody from, you know, Kansas or something coming to here and trying to cover this stuff. You know, your background in history, I guess, is an advantage.
I think so. I think because – like, I didn't realize until I started the website just how similar, like, Louisville fans' memories are, or just how similar we view things, because there wasn't a way for us to all connect before the internet was out there. You talk to people at, you know, parties in high school, and they would be like, oh yeah, Freedom Hall smells like caramel popcorn. You're like, oh my god, I think the same thing. And now you can get on the internet and everybody's like, yeah, I think it smells like caramel popcorn. And there actually is a chapter in the book where I talk to people who worked in Freedom Hall extensively about what they thought Freedom Hall smelled like, because nobody can, you know, exactly put it into words. Paul Rogers did it. Robbie Wine, Marcus Maben, who played for U of L. Pat Forty does it. I think John has a quote there too. But it's stuff like that that makes being a Louisville fan so fun. And what I've always tried to do is just take that experience and kind of put it on the internet, because we love wins and losses. We love talking about great players. But it's more – we wouldn't follow this. We wouldn't care so much about it if it weren't fun. more times than not. Now, you know, less fun right now than usual, but still fun to be a fan.
Well, the jump, this is the last thing we got time for here, but Mike, the jump from like writing about it to especially, I think it's fun to listen because I make fun of them, and I know you can't, but all these callers that sound like they're from, you know, the back 40 or something. I mean, just the logic and, you know, if you tear down what people say to you, I mean, you must get surprised every day or shocked at the things people say on the radio.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because that's exactly like what my mom or dad will be texting me. They're like, oh my God, like, how do you do it? And I'm like, yeah, you know, it's some people out there. You have to be respectful. You love getting calls. They make your show. But there are people who are like, you know, I think the aliens came down and they, you know, shot Tom Jurich with something and this is all a big conspiracy. And you've kind of got to be like, well, I respect your call, but I disagree. I think actually this
is less
cynical.
We got to dump this guy.
Yeah. But it's you're right. It is. There are some interesting calls, but you have to take it as a fun part of the job.
Well, someday we'll have a Rusty Satellite call-in show and not do it this way, and I'll hear everybody complaining about the mayor and all that stuff.
No question.
Which is not as much fun as covering sports, I'm sure. So. You mentioned covering sports, so you still hang around with your buddies and tailgate. You don't do the press box thing, or you do all that?
No, I have actively fought against getting a media pass and go. Yeah. I mean, I feel like for what I do, it really adds no value going to the press conferences, watching from the media room where you can't cheer, you can't drink. You know, I cover the team as a fan. I like to keep that experience alive. I don't care if I look cool on the sidelines. I like sitting in my old seats. It's great.
And it's really weird because if you are in the press box, you know, there's that no cheering thing. And it's like a library up there.
It's no fun.
It's not fun at all.
No.
Even the free food is
not good.
You know, not worth it.
No. I love my section. Shout out to 217. I will sit in those seats and tailgate with my friends until I can.
All right. Well, good. Mike Rutherford, we got to wrap it up here. But the book is 100 Things Louisville Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. So I suggest you get it and see how many of those things you know. Mike, pleasure catching up with you.
Thanks so much for having me. Love the show.
Hey, this is Dan Vonderhyde.
Stephanie White.
And we are 40-ish.
Yeah, I'm getting there.
We talk about it every week on the 40-ish podcast. What do we talk about?
Wisdom. We drop some wisdom and just everything that's going on in our lives that relates to what might be going on in yours.
We have guests. We talk to people on the street. We're dropping knowledge all over the place. You can hear it every Wednesday. Comes out on Louisville.am.
All right. Thank you very much, Mike. Now, I have been starting on both these books of my guests this week. I only have read the first chapter of 100 Things Louisville Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. I think it's going to be great. There's a lot of great stuff in there. I will sort of pick on the first chapter is about Darryl Griffith. That's what I just finished reading. And I certainly wish that there had been that Mike had done more on what Darryl's doing these days. Because I just happened to be a part of a Passport taping with Darryl down at the Darryl Griffith Activity Center or Athletic Center at the West End School. And it's remarkable what's going on down there. I got a chance to spend a little time with Darryl. And it was enlightening. It's really a great story. And there's a room there, if you ever go down there, it's sort of a hall of fame of Darryl Griffith and some of the things. Like, can you imagine, we can't today, but I saw a thing on the wall there, how 15,000 fans went to see Darryl Griffith play in high school at Freedom Hall, which is really something. So anyway, I'm sure it's a great book. I'm looking forward to reading the rest of it. And Mike, thanks for being on the show. Hope you sell a lot of them. I think you will. And we'll keep listening to you and John Ramsey and your take on what's going on with the University of Louisville Athletic Department, where today they hired an assistant coach, a guy named Trent Johnson. Today, I'm saying that on Wednesday, and you're hearing this no sooner than Friday, so that was a big deal. Where else in the country does an assistant coach hiring get the kind of coverage it does around here? You could watch that press conference live on every local TV station if you wanted to. So isn't that wild? Mike and I had a good chance to talk about how media has changed over the years, in just the last 10 years, really, since we both started blogging. It's really gone a long way. No, I don't think it's all for the good, but all for the better. But anyway, I really enjoyed the times back in the Ville Voice days, 2007, 8, and 9, when I was breaking stories ahead of the Courier Journal and the TV stations and, you know, all that was going on. They've kind of caught up now. They've figured out in local media that here and around the country that immediacy is the thing, and that's how our world has changed. Okay. All right, so this part of the show, often talk about what's going on in my life or the life of the city of Louisville. I tell you, last week, you know, I really enjoyed having Alex Raimundo on, the red Mexican, if you will, the Hispanic comedian who is nationally known but lives here in Louisville. I went to the number one comedy show at Mango's in DuPont on Dutchman on Friday night. It was a blast. Really enjoyed it. And got to see Alex perform live and another comedian, and highly recommended. He does it once a month over there, and had some number one tequila with it. I actually went out and spent $40 at Total Wine and More on a bottle of tequila, which I haven't opened yet. But anyway, number one. Very good. So that was the highlight of my weekend last weekend. And so I got some other stuff coming up this weekend. This weekend, in addition to the football game at Papa John's Cardinal Stadium on Saturday at noon, it's the weekend of the Garvin Gate Blues Festival. And now, those of you who have listened to the show know that I've had guests on from Garvin Gate before, and it's just, I've been three or four times. I love, among the music festivals that happen in this town, it's often overlooked, but never a bad time. I'll tell you, they've got 14 acts this year, and Garvin Gate is down there in Old Louisville, about on Oak Street, if you get to 4th and Oak, you'll hear it, and 14 acts, believe it or not. Frank Bang and the Cook County Kings. I love some of the names of the bands, and one, very close to me, I haven't heard this band, I've heard about them, Otis, some who know me know that in college, because of the famous Otis Redding, I was nicknamed Otis. A lot of people still call me that. So anyway, that's what's coming up this weekend. I did notice a couple things in the news this week. Bring to your attention, you know, the hometown hero banners that you see around town. There's a great one of Ali down on downtown, and Diane Sawyer, Jennifer Lawrence, even Bob Edwards and Phil Sims. There's so many. I think there's like three dozen around town, and this foundation has put those up over probably the last 20 years. Well, it was announced this week that they've chosen the final four or five that they're going to put up, and then they're disbanding the group. They think it's run its course. The foundation has basically ended it. So maybe we'll have somebody from the from that foundation on the show in the next few weeks. I know a few of the people involved, but it seems like a very successful thing, and it's always a unique thing about Louisville to see these famous people, banners celebrating them up on the walls. I know, God, think of all the ones, Diane Sawyer, Colonel Sanders. The one this week was was somebody I didn't know about, a black woman who had was the first, attorney that was selected to be a prosecutor in this town. She was murdered in 1965. So there's a lot of stuff like that that you can find out about Louisville. If you're interested in the city of Louisville and the people who are famous here or from here, it's good to go around town. And I think there's a website where you can see all these see the names of all the people that are on these banners. It's really, really a great thing. So anyway, that's a big piece of news this week. But the story I really wanted to get to leads me into my next guest, Norm Stamper, who is Norm, just so you know, started out as a beat cop in San Diego back in 1966, eventually became the police chief in Seattle. And after retirement, he saw all this stuff that was going on around the country with police and wrote a book called Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. All right, the way the story goes, Chris Thieneman read that book, got really intrigued by it, and called up Norm and went out and visited with him. And eventually that resulted in them coming back to Louisville. He made a bunch of media appearances and some community meetings in the West End. So it was a very productive thing, and it's a good thing that Chris did. One of the things we talked about was ways to reduce crime, and Norm is an outspoken, there's a whole chapter in his book about the failure that is America's drug war, going back to Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, and today, the amount of money spent on incarcerating drug crimes and in police enforcement cost, etc. You know, what if it was just that it wasn't illegal? What if it was a product like tobacco or alcohol that we could tax and solve problems like our pension problem here in Kentucky? What if that happened? Wouldn't that be great? Well, it's probably not going to happen, even though I was heartened to see that Senator Dan Syme, a Republican who I've known a little while, is a good friend of Chris Thieneman's, has came out this week in a story saying that he thought that the solution to our pension problem. One of them was to be like Colorado and become a state that legalized marijuana for recreational use. Now, the amount of money that Colorado is making on that, there are disputes, and I'm going to bring up something else. But, you know, certainly I'm in favor of what Syme is saying. I don't think that his proposal is going to get very far, unfortunately, in Kentucky, especially. I listened to our governor, Governor Bevin, our very own mini Trump. Matt Bevin was on Terry Miner's radio show this week, and the subject came up of you know, this pension crisis we're in. How are we going to come up with new money? And basically, you know, the two instant fixes for influx of money into Kentucky would be legalization of marijuana and casino gambling. And so the governor, of course, he said absolutely no and no, not while I'm governor. He calls them suckers bets. And, he pointed to Colorado and mentioned all these problems that he says Colorado has had, and says that Colorado is very, that the political folks in Colorado are very unhappy about the results of marijuana being legalized there. I'm going to have to talk to my son Josh, who works out there, see if he sees these things. Certainly Dan Syme, the Kentucky senator, thinks it would be a good thing for our state. But again, the whole discussion is probably moot because, as I said in my interview with Norm, you know, Kentucky's in a race to be the last state ever to get involved in anything progressive. It's just the way the state works. We are Louisville on an island and a bunch of rural legislators who basically don't want any change, any progressive changes to come to our state. You know, the hypocrisy of not allowing legalized gambling, casino gambling, is amazing, considering we have a lottery here, we have bets on horse races, we have bingo, we have all this stuff, but casino gambling, the one form of gambling that could really raise a lot of money for the state, remains illegal and blocked by our state politician. In fact, Bevin said in his comments to Terry Miners that he didn't see any nobody. He says there's no momentum for any kind of legalized gambling here. He said nobody wants it. Well, you know, a few years ago, a bunch of Louisville businessmen mounted a major campaign to try to get it passed, and it did not work. It did not work. So anyway, so we are what we get here in Kentucky. But anyway, let's move on to Norm Stamper. He's a great guy. I was really glad I got to meet him. Chris came by the Louisville.am studios this week, and really enjoyed talking to Norm. I know he had a great visit here, and I think you'll be interested. You may want to go out and pick up his book. It's called To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. Here's my interview with Norm Stamper.
Hi, this is Alec Bowles, co-host of the What Happens Next podcast on Louisville.am. We talk about improv each week with, we are the Louisville Improvisers. With,
yeah, totally.
With Chris Anger and Brian Hines.
Yeah.
And Jenny.
Where's my water?
Okay. Well, right now we're just having a few treats. So we hope you can listen. Find us at Louisville.am in iTunes or using the Stitcher app on your iPhone or Android device.
And today, the Rusty Satellite Show is glad to have Norm Stamper in the Louisville.am studios. Norm, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
You're all the way from Washington, as basically brought here by Chris Thieneman to talk about policing, right?
That's correct.
Okay. And how, I'm just curious, because we all know Chris around here, but how did you run into him, and how did this all happen?
Well, he ran into me, which is, I think, the norm for Chris. He had read a review of my book in the Wall Street Journal and said, I got to get this book. He did. He read it. And then he said, I got to talk to this guy. So he flew out to Washington, and we had a long lunch, and it was, I think, very very productive conversation about what needs to change in American law enforcement.
Okay. Well, we talk a lot about police and crime around in Louisville as well as many other cities. Your book, How to Fix America's Police, focuses on just a general idea of where you think this should go.
Well, I do have an 8-point plan. I've read the President's Task Force on 21st Century Report, and there are well over 100 recommendations, a similar kind of product in Chicago, where the mayor there appointed a task force to say, well, what do we do about the mistrust that exists between too many citizens and too many police officers? And I've decided that it's better to pick a few specific recommendations, however fundamental they may seem, however radical they may seem, and get a conversation going about them. Policing is about public safety. It's about helping communities to stop people from hurting other people and providing emergency services. How do we accomplish that? We can accomplish it on one level unilaterally. And sometimes arbitrarily, where the police make all the policy decisions and program decisions and priority decisions and the like. Or we can put police and community together in a true, I mean, an authentic partnership.
Okay. Okay. Now, you were, your background, of course, I read you were a beat cop in the beginning in San Diego, I believe, and then you eventually became the chief of police in Seattle. And, I'm curious in terms of when you were on the job and doing this work, did you know then, you know, some of these solutions that are in your book? Or I mean, were you a different kind of police chief than all the other ones, like Steve Conrad here in Louisville?
Well, I think we need to start, at least in my situation, with my rookie year. I had become a police officer resolving that I would be a different kind of cop from the ones I'd experienced in my youth. And I will openly acknowledge that I wasn't particularly easy, I'm sure, for the local police to handle either. But I did have some unpleasant experiences with police officers. Nothing big, nothing dramatic, but I thought, why can't you smile? Why can't you talk to me as one human being to another?
Right.
And so I decide, you know, I'm going to be that kind of cop who's sensitive and responsive and maybe even a little compassionate and responsible. I'm not going to use the N word. I'm not going to use excessive force. I'm going to be a good cop. And that lasted about 5 minutes.
I say, you must have been naive.
I was very naive, and I openly confessed to my naivete. I found myself gravitating toward the officers generally who used the coarsest language, who used excessive force in kind of systematic ways, who made unlawful stops. They're oftentimes called Terry stops or stop and frisk. And I actually enjoyed that. I think it's important to share with your listeners that the power went right to my head. Mm-hmm. The badge on my chest became quite heavy. And whether or not I was literally swaggering, I knew that something was happening to me, and I liked it. I embraced it. There are personal and psychological reasons, I'm sure, for every individual candidate who follows that course. But I got stopped in my tracks by a prosecutor I was about 14 months on the job, and I had made a bad arrest, and by that I mean a false arrest.
Okay.
A 19-year-old kid arrested for being drunk in a public place and unable to care for himself for the safety of others. And I presented this case to the prosecutor in the hallway outside the presiding courtroom. And he said, was he drunk? And I said, well, he was, I'll blip myself. I used in profanity. And I said, so he was that kind of a person. And he said, was he drunk? And I said, well, he called me a pig. And he said, Officer Stamper, was the man drunk? And my response was no. At which point he asked me if the United States Constitution meant anything to me. So I got slapped upside the head by a principal prosecutor who wasn't playing the game that I had seen played.
Right.
My senior officers and experienced prosecutors with a wink and a poke and a nod and let's just move on, we'll dismiss this case. Well, that wasn't good enough for him. And he said, if you ever bring me another case like this, I'm going to be going directly to the chief's office. And he put the fear of God in me. Okay. He also enraged me, by the way. Yeah. Like, what nerve do you have? You're this pinstripe-suited prosecutor with your slick-back Hollywood hairdo and your tortoiseshell glasses. You're prowling the hallways of, you know, out of the elements in the courthouse. You've got a private office. You have colleagues to consult with. I'm out there on my own. Working the mean streets of San Diego. I'm out there in the heat and cold San Diego. And I had this moment of real anger that quickly morphed into embarrassment. And as I wrote in my first book, by the time I'm slithering down the stairs of the San Diego County Courthouse into a bright, sunshiny San Diego day, I was awash in shame. Huh. It really affected me.
Well, there you go. I mean, I guess the thing we're really talking about and the real topic here, you know, it sounds like that sort of transformed you from, you know, one of these terrible cops to a decent cop. And but the thing that's in the news all the time is this was a bad cop. You know, something bad happens. A white cop shoots a black kid in some urban city, and it's this guy's a bad apple. But mm-hmm. but you're not preaching that message.
I am preaching the message that if we continue to see these, quote, isolated incidents, mm-hmm. if we continue to see or experience bad apples in a particular police department, we might want to question the barrel, because we know that in otherwise ripe and healthy fruit, a bad apple is, in fact, going to contaminate that entire barrel okay. of apples. So I'm not going to push this metaphor to extremes, but I think it is important that we look at the structure of policing. Okay. I am not critical of police officers. I have enormous respect for my former colleagues. They do delicate, demanding, oftentimes dangerous work. It's a really tough, tough job. And I don't think we're doing a service to our police officers by creating organizational impediments to effective police practices, to okay. good police community relations.
But as you've publicized your book and talked about policing around the country, it seems like some of your biggest critics are people in the police business, I guess.
That's
the
correct.
Police officer.
Absolutely.
And so that must be a challenge for you. Now what we're doing here is not going to air till Thursday. So let me just go back and say we're talking on Monday. You've got a big event or two planned in the city. What are you trying to? What do you know about Louisville and its police situation? And what message are you bringing to these?
Well, people? I know a lot less than I should, okay. but I'm not here to consult with the police department. I am here to provide opportunities for conversation between citizens and any police officers who may happen to show up at these various events over the course of the week. And I'm convinced that there are a half a dozen major topics that really do demand joint community police conversation, creating opportunities for us to question the extent to which fear, for example, might be motivating a police officer in a delicate situation. Mm-hmm. Fear almost always produces a compensating behavior. Fear is not a socially acceptable emotion in most police departments. So the last thing I can do is admit that I'm afraid of a particular situation. So what do? I compensate or overcompensate, and I react angrily. I raise my voice. Maybe the pitch goes up two or three octaves, and I'm out
of
control.
And at some point, you pull a gun, right?
In some situations, certainly, that's done. Now, I don't believe that we have police officers in this country who are setting out on a given shift to kill somebody. I don't believe that at all. I know the opposite to be true. But I also know that it's altogether too easy to allow a situation to escalate. Mm-hmm. And that police officers have a wonderful opportunity as professionals on the scene to present in a calm, mature, self-disciplined fashion an alternative to the kinds of officers who, frankly, in many cases, have been trained to act the way they're acting, which actually escalates rather than de-escalates situations.
And now it's all crystal clear to me. I can see why you're getting resistance, because you're talking about change. You're asking these people to change the way they've conducted themselves, the way they operate as police officers.
And you know, nobody likes to be told you've been doing it wrong. Mm-hmm. Nobody likes to be questioned about policies or procedures or tactics that, from the point of view of the individual officers or of an entire department, have been working. It's the community saying, wait a minute, really? It's not working from our point of view. And I do speak about young people and poor people and people of color. Historically, the relations between cops and those communities have been the most strange, the most conflict-ridden. Do we want to do something about that? Are we committed to improving community police relations in historically difficult situations?
Yeah, yeah. And we got to wrap it up pretty soon, but I want to get to this question. It seems like, to me, as not somebody involved in policing, that there is so much to do with drugs, there is such a prevalence of guns, and the problems that seem to rise to the surface all seem to have to do with race. And I don't know if you, is that something that is, I don't know if fixable is the right word, but what steps are you advising people to take to solve this?
Well, first, I guess I should point out that I am advocating a massive citizens movement, a grassroots movement designed to improve the relations between community and police, and I cite different structured ways of accomplishing that, that I'm sure we don't have time to delve into. But I do believe this. When Richard Nixon famously proclaimed drug abuse public enemy number one and declared all-out war on drugs, he was really declaring war against his own people. You don't fight a war without an enemy. The frontline soldiers in that war were not the feds, not even DEA, but rather local police departments. So that starting in the 70s, we basically poised police officers as foot soldiers to wage war against their own people. What if we had taken an entirely different tack? What if we had framed the drug problem, and we have a major drug problem, and not just the opioid crisis in this country, but what if we had said drug use, drug abuse, all of that is a public health, not a criminal justice issue. Those who are addicted or otherwise afflicted and have a drug problem are medical patients who are in need of medical help. I think one of the worst things that we can do is take a low-level, nonviolent drug offender and put them behind bars, rather than holding them accountable for any behavior, driving impaired, furnishing to a kid, those kinds of things, and to extricate ourselves from the drug war. Mm-hmm. The American people overwhelmingly now oppose the drug war. They have come to recognize the folly. Despite the damage that it's caused, tens of millions of people incarcerated, fractured families and the like, we are now faced with a really unfortunate reality, and that is drugs are more readily available at lower prices and higher levels of potency than ever before. That represents a colossal failure of public policy and of imagination. And I think if the people were to get behind it, we could, in fact, end the drug war, replace prohibition with a regulatory model. This is a community. I come from a state that has legalized cannabis for adults. It has set sensible regulations that are being rigorously enforced. States are making money that can be pumped back into prevention, education, and treatment and other causes. And it's been an enormous success in those states that have passed that legislation.
If you could only get some of our legislators to pay attention to you, because I think Kentucky is in a race to become the 50th state to legalize marijuana. That's what's going to happen around here. But as we got to wrap it up, Norm, I've sure enjoyed being with you. I want to tell people how to get your book. It's called How to Fix America's Police by Norm Stamper. I guess it's in local bookstores.
Yeah, it's actually To Protect and Serve is the title, and okay. The subtitle is, which I like,
there it
is How to Fix.
Yeah.
Just a little presumptuous on my part. But.
Well, I read about half of it last night. It's a great read, and I really enjoyed it. If you don't know Chris Thieneman, who will give you one for free, you have to go to a bookstore, or I'm sure you can look it up online, right?
Yes.
All right, Norm.
So much.
Well, continue your media tour. Welcome to Louisville. Glad to have you here, and anxious to find out if you can make some progress here.
It's wonderful to be here, and I hope and believe that that's possible.
And there you have it. Norm Stamper, thank you for coming all the way from Seattle to be on the Rusty Satellite Show. And Mike Rutherford, thanks for coming all the way from St. Matthews to be on the Rusty Satellite Show. We had a good time with both guests, and both of them have great books out that you may want to just pick up. Shouldn't we read more? I tell you, I just finished the Bruce Springsteen bio Born to Run is absolutely fantastic reading experience. And you know, we just don't read enough. Unfortunately, my son Luke, who is 19, I've got him reading, and he's very interested in the world and the politics of the world and everything. I got him reading The Right Stuff by Tom Wolfe, what I consider the most influential book on, you know, my reading life, I guess, that ever happened. I can't remember when I read that. Must have been in college or so. But anyway, thanks to Passport Health Plan for helping make this show possible. The Rusty Satellite Show is episode number 223. It happens with the help of a lot of good folks who helped me find interesting guests. If you know of a guest, someone who would be a great guest on this show, be sure and get in touch with me. I'm easy to find on Facebook under Rick Redding, or there is a Rusty Satellite Show page on Facebook. There's all kinds of things. I also own and operate the LouisvilleKY.com, the Pulse of the City. It's a website that details a lot of the things that are happening around town. So I urge you to make a visit over there. And if you really get motivated, you can get in touch with me. You can get on my weekly email mailing list and find out who is on the Rusty Satellite Show each and every week. We are available on iTunes and a number of different podcast platforms, but the most interesting podcast in the city is right here at the Rusty Satellite Show. So thank you for joining me. Thanks to my guests for coming in, and go ahead and have some fun this weekend. I'm going to see you out at the Garvin Gate Blues Festival and at the UofL football game. So I'll see you there.
Thanks for listening to the Rusty Satellite Podcast with your host, Rick Redding. Next week, Rick will be right back here on Louisville.am with another stellar lineup of great guests. You can let Rick know what you think by sending an email to rick@louisvilleky.com. He's on Twitter, too, at Ricky Redding. For more information about the show, including photos of Rusty Satellite Show guests, go to louisvilleky.com, the pulse of the city.
Time.